we can measure sea level rise, which is happening at a rate of about an inch per decade, globally, everywhere in the world, from space. And just think about that for a minute. Our planet is covered by water over two-thirds of its surface. And if that two-thirds of the planet's surface is changing all at once, that's an incredibly big signal. We're really literally reshaping the planet Earth under our changing climate. And we can measure that from space with incredible accuracy.
Blue Dot, Episode 4, El Niño, 2016.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm, along with co-host Matt Schiltz. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Dave.
Today we're talking about what's been on everybody's minds all fall and into the winter, El Niño.
We're going to talk with NASA oceanographer Josh Willis, one of the world's leading experts on climate change and El Niño. He, along with others, predicted this El Niño with satellite observations last spring.
Boy, has it thus far really come to pass.
And he's also involved with the JASON satellite series.
And we're going to talk also about JASON 3, which just successfully launched from the Vandenberg Air Force Base, and how those satellites are letting us monitor what happens in the ocean and how it controls our weather, especially here in California. We caught up with Josh at the AMS, American Meteorological Society convention in New Orleans. And what are you doing there?
I'm having a good time, Dave. But being on your show is the best time I've had so far in New Orleans.
We want to talk about El Niño and later on talk about JASON 3. But I'd like to start with talking to you about El Niño. First of all, what do you think people's biggest misconception is when they hear the term El Niño?
Oh, well, thanks to the glorious and magical Chris Farley, everybody thinks El Niño is a storm. I am the greatest storm master of all other storms. If you remember the 1998 sketch on Saturday Night Live with Chris Farley, he kind of characterized El Niño as the greatest storm of all. So El Niño is not really a storm. It's not really a thing that happens in the atmosphere. It really happens in the ocean. And when you think about El Niño, you know, we often think, especially in California, we think about, oh, it's going to be stormy. We're going to have all this wet weather. But really, it's all driven by what's happening in the oceans.
So give us a El Niño 101. Tell us exactly how an El Niño forms and what exactly it is.
Well, El Niño happens when the Pacific Ocean decides, kind of like a great seesaw, to shift a whole lot of warm water that's normally in the west over to the eastern Pacific. And this slide of all this huge volume of warm water is actually what rearranges the jet stream, changes rainfall all over the world, and just causes kind of climate havoc for about a year.
Why is it called El Niño?
Well, it's originally called El Niño because Peruvian fishermen noticed that around Christmas time, around the turn of the year, the water would be unseasonably warm. You'd get really warm water, and things like the lobster and crab fisheries would be thrown out of whack. And fishermen ultimately really named it in Peru after Jesus, because it always happened right around Christmas. The peak was always right around Christmas.
Can you explain to our listeners what is it that you observe, like that you've seen, especially from space, from the NASA satellites that you monitor? How does it begin to manifest itself?
Well, what we see in the JASON data, which JASON is a satellite or a series of satellites that measure the height of the ocean. We see extra high sea levels in the western Pacific over the eastern Pacific. So the eastern Pacific falls, the western Pacific rises, and this is because all of this warm water is moving from west to east across the equator in the Pacific Ocean. And in in terms of sea levels, what we see are really high sea levels, normally like a foot higher in a big El Nino, along the coast of South America. And then it starts to spread north and south. So you see it in Baja and Mexico and ultimately all the way up to California and sometimes Oregon and Washington.
And what exactly, do we have any idea what the mechanism is that starts this to happen? Are there any ideas?
Sure. In the Pacific Ocean, right along the equator, the ocean and the air interact. It's like a playground for the oceans to reach out and kind of shake up things in the atmosphere. And so what's really going on is that as this warm water moves across the equator from west to east in the Pacific, the bands of rain and convection follow it. So the atmosphere actually starts to shift its area of what's called deep convection. That's where warm surface air is carried, the heat is carried up in the atmosphere, causes rain, and that increases the convection. And there's this feedback. So what happens is when it starts to slide to the west, the atmosphere follows it, and then that can actually reinforce the cycle because it changes the winds, which usually pile up the warm water in the west. So as the westerlies, or as the winds start to relax, then that water actually spills eastward across the equator and begins to kind of reinforce itself through the changes in the atmosphere.
And how does that system start to affect our weather here, specifically in California?
Well, especially in California wintertime. In the wintertime, that's when we get really all of our rain in California. January, February, March, those are the big rain months. And during that time is usually when El Nino peaks. So we get a big blob of warm water along the equator, just off of South America, the Peruvian coast. Central America can also have a lot of warm water off the coast. And that warm water pushes the jet stream north. So the storms that usually hit Mexico wind up being pushed north by this blob of warm water. And we get a series of storms out of the west, which bring rain to us all winter long.
I'm Matt Schiltz here with Dave Shlom. We're talking to NASA oceanographer Josh Willis about El Nino.
Thus far, how are things looking compared to El Ninos in the past?
Well, this is a big one. The last really big one was 1997-98. And that was El Nino Grande, the really big El Nino, really the El Nino of the century. This El Nino is almost the same size, maybe a little smaller, maybe a little bigger, depends on kind of how you count how big it is. But this is a massive event, and it's probably going to bring a series of storms throughout the winter. Now, we're not talking about the weather, the next seven-day forecast. We're talking about the next 3 months. We expect to see increased rainfall across the southern United States.
And probably through March.
And probably through March, yeah.
And when do you start to usually see a signal that El Nino is dying out?
Well, March, April, May, the warm waters in the east start to subside. They kind of dissipate. They spread north and south. You can see this in terms of the high sea levels moving up and down the coast of South America and North America. And slowly the winds start to pick back up. These winds blow from east to west, normally along the equator, and that lifts up water from the deep ocean and cools off the eastern Pacific. And when that process starts up again, that's when we'll say El Nino is pretty much done.
All right, let's talk a little bit about how you study this from space. Let's talk about the JASON satellites. Can you give us just a real quick history of the JASON series?
Well, yeah, the JASON missions are the best satellites we have. I say that because I'm an oceanographer, and I cut my teeth. I got my PhD using data from Topex Poseidon, which was the first sea level mission. Went up in 1992 and started delivering all this amazing data showing us how tall the ocean was. So the JASON missions are pretty simple. They fly around and they bounce a radar wave off of the ocean and time how long it takes to go down and come back up. So using the time it takes to go down and come back up, they can figure out how far away the ocean is from the satellite to within an accuracy of just a centimeter or so. Then the other thing you have to know is where the satellite is. So these things have a GPS and they have two or three other systems that tell us where in space the satellite is. And using both those pieces of information, how far away the ocean is and where it is in space, you can say how tall the oceans are. And that's what really tells us how the oceans are changing. And it also tells us about global sea level rise. So we can see the footprint of human-caused climate change from space.
We just launched a new JASON satellite, didn't we?
Yeah, that's right. JASON 3 just lifted off from Vandenberg Air Force Base reached orbit, and pretty soon it will. It takes a few days, some time to get into orbit, its final orbit, but it's going to begin measuring sea level right next to JASON 2. So the two are going to fly about 60 seconds apart, right in the same orbit, measure the same ocean and the same atmosphere, and this is how we'll build our sea level record into the next 20 years, well, hopefully the next 20 years, the next 5 or 6 years at least for JASON 3, carry on the record of sea level change from space.
And just, you know, to me, this is a very valuable aspect of how taxpayers' money is being used to monitor something that's terribly important to our economy, to California, to knowing what our weather is going to be like. You know, everybody's been dying to know about El Nino. It's like if you turn on the television, there are advertisements saying, you know, get your gutters cleaned out, El Nino is coming, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, to me, this is a really good example of a really cost-effective program where science is being used for, you know, excellent public good.
Well, yeah, the JASON missions give us all kinds of really great scientific information. They're, in fact, used by the Navy to help navigate ships, to help figure out where things like oil spills are going to go, because they tell us about the surface currents. But they also show us things like El Nino. Whenever the warm water piles up in the east, you can really see it as sort of an extra foot or so of high sea levels all over the eastern Pacific around the equator. So in a way, the satellite measurements of sea surface height are one of our most powerful tools for measuring the ocean and how it's changing under our ever-changing climate from space. So they're really an incredible tool.
And what do you say to people, because we deal with this all the time, that, you know, they listen to the information you're giving about El Nino, and yet they still, there's a lot of people that doubt the science behind climate change, which is what you're compiling right now. What's like your main takeaway message for them?
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I talk to people about global warming all the time, and as a climate scientist, when I'm at a cocktail party and I tell somebody, oh, I study global warming, they say, well, is global warming real? And my answer is always, yes, absolutely. Global warming's real. It's caused by people. And to me, one of the most important pieces of evidence that we have is the changing oceans. We can measure sea level rise, which is happening at a rate of about an inch per decade, globally, everywhere in the world, from space. And just think about that for a minute. Our planet is covered by water over two-thirds of its surface. And if that two-thirds of the planet's surface is changing all at once, that's an incredibly big signal. We're really literally reshaping the planet Earth under our changing climate. And we can measure that from space with incredible accuracy. So usually it's just that if you don't think the climate's changing and people are the cause, it's because you haven't really looked at the evidence for it, because the evidence is clear and overwhelming.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. We're talking to NASA oceanographer Josh Willis. We'll be right back in a moment after the break. We'll talk a little bit about what makes Josh tick. And we're back. You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. We are talking with NASA oceanographer Josh Willis.
I'd like to shift gears just a little bit and find out a little bit more about Josh Willis, the oceanographer and the person. How did you first get interested in science? When did that first get going for you?
Well, I developed a kind of fascination with the world at a very young age. When I was 5 or 6, my parents remember that I used to started asking them questions that they couldn't answer anymore about physics and how the world worked. And I remember sometime in my early teens, I picked up a book about Einstein's theory of general relativity, and I read it cover to cover, and I started asking my parents all these questions about the speed of light and how space was bent and everything. And they ran out of answers for me, much to my dismay. And sometime during that process, I kind of developed this curiosity that ultimately led me to try to study physics for a while and then eventually oceanography. And in a way, I was really fascinated by the big problems, things like global climate change, global sea level rise. I wanted to understand and work on stuff that really mattered to people's everyday lives.
If you could spend a day with any person, scientific or otherwise, any time in the past, anybody at all, who would that be?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think it would be somebody like Charles Keeling. One of the very first people to really measure the atmosphere and how it's changed in a way that is indelibly indelibly marked by human activity. To really look at that first data set and say, wow, I can see the footprint of human activity on the planet in a way that's going to change the climate for all of our lifetimes and the lifetimes of our children and grandchildren. I think that'd be really exciting and fun. I mean, it's exciting and fun, but scary at the same time too, of course, right?
Another question along the same lines. If you could go anywhere on the planet, spend a day without worrying about travel or anything, just you get a day, you just be there, bam, where would it be?
Oh, I'd love to see the coral reefs, the Great Barrier Reef. You know, these places are actually really, really threatened by climate change. The warming oceans are and overfishing. These are delicate ecosystems that are really beautiful and also really under threat. And so I'd like to see those things before they disappear. You know, if I had a second day, I'd probably fly to Antarctica and look at the great ice sheets and watch them fall off and disappear into the oceans.
You have been spending time in Greenland, right?
Well, I haven't been to Greenland yet. I've sent a ship to Greenland. We have this project, Oceans Melting Greenland, or OMG for short, that's investigating the role of the oceans in melting away the Greenland ice sheet. And we sent a ship out last year. I didn't get to get on the ship, sadly. But this year, we're beginning aircraft operations. So we'll be flying planes around Greenland, trying to measure the ocean and the ice and look at how much the warm water could be eating away at the glaciers.
If there's one thing you'd like people to know about the work NASA does studying the Earth, what would that be?
Well, I think that NASA really takes the global view of things like climate change, of the human impact on the Earth. And so I think the thing that people have to realize is that we're talking about changes that affect the whole planet. And NASA is uniquely poised to measure those things because when you fly a satellite, you really get a view of the whole Earth. And it's that big view that really, to me, is the most compelling and interesting part of watching the planet change. Because, you know, like I said earlier, the ocean covers 2/3 of the planet. So we're really reshaping the entire Earth. And that's something that only NASA can help us see from its sort of bird's eye view in space.
And when you want to spend some time away from all this heavy-duty stuff, studying oceanography, climate change, what do you do to chill?
Well, Dave, I like to do, I like to get on stage and act and do comedy and improv.
So why don't you do some for us now?
I just did. This whole interview was improv. Come on.
So what are some of the things you dial in for comedy to make people laugh? What do you like to talk about?
Well, one of the great things about doing improvisational theater is that you never know what you're going to have to talk about. And so you have to learn to make it up as you go, which is exactly the opposite of what we do in science, right? We never get to just have fun and make it up on the spot. So I think the thing that I really love the most about doing this kind of theater is that there's no net. You're just out there winging it, and sometimes that's fun.
What's it like when, because all comedians go through this, what's it like when it's not fun and when it doesn't go well?
We all fail. We all fail on stage, you know, and we all fail in life too. It's sort of a reminder that that even when you do, it doesn't usually kill you. You know, you get up and you move on and you try something else. So like learning to cope with failure, I think, is one of the things that I really gained an appreciation for. Of course, I failed many times before I got on stage, but, you know, you feel it the most when you hear those crickets out in the audience.
Who's some of the comic influences you really like?
Oh, you know, I love Dave Chappelle. I think he was just, he still is a brilliant comedian. And, you know, I think what's amazing about him is his ability to take kind of difficult messages and ideas. He, you know, a lot of the material that he does kind of hits you where it hurts. It's socially relevant. It's interesting. It's important. And it's still really, really funny. So how do you make things that aren't funny funny? That's kind of why I got into comedy in the first place.
What's your favorite movie of all time?
Oh, you know, I just watched Star Wars, and then I rewatched all the Star Wars. I love Star Wars, man. I'm a Star Wars baby. I grew up watching Star Wars.
And did you like the new one?
I did. I loved it.
And did you cry?
Yeah, two or three times.
Just checking, because if you didn't cry, you don't really love it.
I definitely cried, yeah. I cried when I saw the Millennium Falcon the first time, actually.
There was that one moment for me when I knew it was coming, because it's like, well, okay, it's his son. Oh, no.
No spoilers, man. Come on. People still.
Hey, my attitude about that now is if you have not seen the movie by the time this airs, then, you know, you definitely have too much of a life. Matt, it's your turn. Do you have a question you'd like to ask Josh?
Yeah. Hey, Josh, when I Google you, and don't take it personally, I Google everyone we talk to, even if we've talked to them a lot of times before, like you.
That's okay. I don't feel it when you Google me.
It kind of looks like someone's out to get you with all, there's just all of these terrible photos of you, and they're really, really easy to find. What's up with that?
Yeah, you know, and some of them are my friends, too. There was one video that I made at JPL, and there's this fountain, and the fountain's on in the background. And for whatever reason, they chose a screen grab where the fountain was kind of making this weird bubbly thing, you know? And I was mid-sentence, you know, I looked like I had about four chins, and I had a dumb look in my eyes, and my eyebrows are all wrinkled. It was horrible, the worst picture you... But the fountain looked beautiful. The fountain looked beautiful, Matt.
All right. Well, we've been talking to oceanographer Josh Willis from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, joining us from New Orleans and the American Meteorological Association meeting.
That's right. AMS in the Big Easy.
There's like thousands of meteorologists descending upon New Orleans right now, correct?
That's right. It is Nerd Central.
Are they like just like TV weather people and everybody involved? People from the National Weather Service?
Definitely. There's a lot of Weather Service folks here. There's atmospheric scientists from universities all over the place. It's a big hodgepodge. But it was most interesting right at the beginning of the weekend when there was also a Comic-Con convention in the same convention center. So I got a picture of Wolverine with a whole bunch of nerds in the background, and you can't tell if they're scientists or comic book nerds. It's great.
All righty, sir. Well, it was really fun talking to you, as always.
Oh, that was a blast. I really enjoyed that.
Blue Dot's a production of North State Public Radio. Visit us at mynspr.org. Check us out on Twitter at @NSPRNews. Follow me at Dave Shlohm, and I am reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.
Next time on Blue Dot, we talk with science communicator Diana Cowan, a.k.a. Physics Girl.
It's a basic part of human nature to be curious. If you don't explore your world, you're never going to learn. You're never going to figure out what things hurt you, what things help you. It's just a way of surviving, and curiosity, I mean, it's part of human survival, but I think it's a wonderful part that I'm happy to have. And I think being childish isn't cool when you get to middle school, when you get to high school. It's like, you know, you want to be mature and you want to be cool. I think the best popular kids are the ones that are goofy and curious, as well as being seen as cool. And that's what I aspired to. I was never cool, but but that's what I aspired to, was to keep, you know, my passion for all the things I liked, like music and science and math, as well as being seen as popular. Never got there, but it's what I aspired to.